Welcome to This Week in Brattleboro History,
produced by
the Brattleboro Historical Society
and
the Brattleboro Area Middle School.
Carrie Ballester grew up with privilege. She was born in 1862. On her father's side, her grandparents were very wealthy and well-connected. Carrie's grandfather made a great deal of money speculating on the land along the northwestern frontier and then capitalized on those profits by entering the real estate world of New York City in the mid-1800s. Her paternal grandparents retired to Vermont in the 1860s.
Carrie was the second of four children. Her father was a real estate lawyer. Her mother's family was located in Rochester, New York, and was also quite well off. Carrie spent her early years in Rochester. Unfortunately, her father passed away when she was only 8 years old. From that time forward, Carrie split her time between Rochester, New York, and her paternal grandparents' home from Brattleboro.
Wolcott, Carrie's older brother, attended Cornell University. Carrie often visited her brother at Cornell. Classmates of Wolcott described brother and sister as flamboyant. They spent a great deal of time together and enjoyed one another's company.
Here are excerpts from an article written by a classmate of Wolcott's, published in a Minnesota newspaper.
Quote, like her brother, Caroline adopted extremes in fashion. She was a graceful dancer and came to Rochester purposely to attend some college functions with her brother. But it cannot truthfully be said she was ever a belle of the Cornell balls. Miss Ballester was seldom without a book in her hand, whether at home or on the street. She and her brother Wolcott used to go across the college campus out to the little grove of maple trees along Mill Creek, and there read to each other for hours.
The author of the article suggested that Carrie and Wolcott were very similar. Wolcott was thought of as the more creative of the two, while Carrie was described as bland and supportive of Wolcott's idiosyncrasies.
After a year, Wolcott dropped out of Cornell and began looking for a place in the literary world. Carrie accompanied him on trips to Colorado, where they explored the West for months at a time. Wolcott had some articles published in the Atlantic Monthly and eventually landed a job as a literary agent for the John Lovell Publishing Company of New York City. He was assigned to England with the task of signing European authors to American contracts. Wolcott invited Carrie to join him in order to help with the recruiting process. Carrie was expected to organize artistic gatherings in the London rooms rented by the Ballesters. She acted as hostess of these events and took care of the logistics. It was in this setting that Carrie met British author Rudyard Kipling, and they were eventually married.
The young couple settled near the family estate along the Brattleboro/Dummerston border and built a home next to Carrie's younger brother, Beatty. Local historian Mary Cabot became a family friend of the Kiplings. Here's Cabot's description of Carrie Kipling.
Mrs. Kipling was, in many respects, an admirable wife for a genius. She guarded his health, assumed the supervision of every detail of the routine of his daily life, published his works, was his business agent, and stood between him and any obstacles to the free and full development of his powers.
Cabot went on to say that Carrie was not very friendly towards visitors.
Mary Cabot also wrote about Rudyard Kipling.
As long as I knew him, he lamented the lack of a leisure class in America.
The separation of classes was an issue for the Kiplings. When they arrived there, there were about 6,000 people living in Brattleboro. Census numbers indicate that approximately 100 of them were domestic servants working for the town's leisure class. The Brookes, Bradleys, Goodhues, and Cabots were some of the families who employed multiple live-in servants. The Kiplings also hired live-in servants and struggled with keeping employees. Some said Miss Kipling was a difficult employer.
Eventually, English servants were hired to support the Kipling household. Vermont's sensibilities were not the same as English sensibilities. The Kiplings were friendly with those of a certain standing, but expected separation from others. Kipling wrote about all sorts of people, but didn't seem keen on spending time with those who were not of his social class.
Mary Cabot also wrote about the family conflict that caused the Kiplings to leave Brattleboro in 1896.
It was a Ballester feud, beginning in childhood with a natural antagonism between the inconsequential characteristics of Beatty and the disciplinary temperament of his sister Carrie.
According to Cabot, when the Kiplings moved to Brattleboro, they hired Beatty to oversee the construction of their house.
When the Kiplings projected the building of Nalaka, they gave Beatty a means of sustenance, the superintendence of workmen, and the purchase of materials for house and stables, also the development of the grounds. It was understood in the village that Kipling carried Beatty, whose unpaid bills were therefore permitted to run indefinitely. Beatty's house, Maplewood, was heavily mortgaged, and there were notes owing the bank by Beatty, which had been signed by his mother and Mrs. Kipling. He did not perform his part of the Nalaka contract satisfactorily. Finally, Mrs. Kipling accused him of appropriating money given to him to pay the workmen.
Again, according to Mary Cabot, Carrie took steps to have the loans on Beatty's house called in by the bank. Her hope was that Beatty would become more responsible and find employment with someone outside of the family. Beatty heard from his younger sister, Josephine, about Carrie's attempt to call in the loans and went to Nalaka to confront the Kiplings. Carrie refused to let Beatty in the house and would not listen to his explanations.
Cabot went on to write,
"One day, as Beatty was driving to the village, he came unexpectedly on Rudyard Kipling, who was on a bicycle. Beatty jumped to the ground close to his brother-in-law and thundered out the words, 'If you don't listen to me, Rudd, I'll blow your damn brains out.' Mr. Kipling's coachman was just behind and came to the rescue by seizing his master and seating him in the carriage, which was driven quickly home. Beatty drove directly to my house on Tyler Street from the scene in the woods to tell me what had happened and express some anxiety at having frightened Rudd almost to death. Mr. Kipling believed that Beatty had meant to take his life. Consulting with his wife, he decided his safety could be assured only by some method which would intimidate Beatty. With no thought of the possible consequences, he sent a sheriff to arrest Beatty for assault. A preliminary hearing took place where Beatty was charged with assault, indecent epithets, and threatening to kill. Distressed on finding that any publicity was given to the case, Mr. Kipling offered to furnish bail to release Beatty. It was disdainfully refused. That Rudyard Kipling had arrested his brother-in-law was telegraphed to the ends of the earth. Reporters from leading and sensational journals arrived by night and day, bearing kodaks and armed with retaliation for the man who made it a practice to repulse their requests for interviews."
During the hearing,
Mr. Kipling's testimony was so contradictory that the audience cheered and laughed, and the sympathy so freely given to him at first by the townspeople turned to Beatty, his loafing habits, debts, and drinking forgotten because the author broke down. It was pitiful.
Local newspapers described Kipling as anxious, uncomfortable, and unable to sit still during the hearing. Cabot wrote,
"Kipling said there was nothing for him to do but leave the country or remain to be the object of further ridicule. Mr. Kipling decided to go to England, which was a terrible disappointment to himself as well as to his wife. As the cruel situation forced itself more and more keenly on their already wounded sensibilities, their atmosphere became harsh and strained. During the remaining 3 months of their stay in America, Mr. Kipling rarely moved, even within the limits of his own land, without the protection of some friend. It was evident that he still believed that his life was in danger. I felt the Kiplings were right, but they might have dealt with their brother in a more dignified way. Beatty proved himself a bully, yet he had some reason for resentment."
When the Kiplings moved to England, they eventually purchased a private 33-acre country manor set on a hill, away from the closest town. As the years went on, surrounding land and buildings near the estate were purchased until the Kiplings owned about 300 acres. They made sure neighborly squabbles would no longer be an issue.
After arriving in England, Carrie wrote a letter of advice to a friend contemplating marriage.
"I would not marry a literary man for worlds. They are always doing too much, and one can only help them by being hopelessly dull, so they may relax their minds and rest themselves in the security of one's stupidity."
The Kiplings never returned to Brattleboro.
Nalaka's annual rhododendron tour is coming up June 2-3 this year. At that time, the home and grounds will be open to anyone for a visit.
We'd like to thank Gilbert, Ethan, David, Evan, Pfeiffer, Charlie, Lexi, and Brielle for reading This Week in Brattleboro History.
Please join us next week for another story from our community's past.